up on my knee, sonny boy. Boy, you're only three, sonny boy. You've no way of knowing, there's no way of showing what you mean to me, sonny boy.
Sonny Boy, one of the most successful theme songs ever written, may be said to have introduced the sound film to Ireland. It was sung by Al Jolson in The Singing Fool, the film which marked the opening of the Capitol Cinema in Dublin on the 21st of April 1929. The coming of the sound film may have revolutionised the whole business of film exhibition in Ireland, as it did everywhere else. But as far as film making here was concerned, it doesn't seem to have made a great deal of difference. Colm O'Leary, one of our best documentary filmmakers, put it like this.
Sound came, in the late 20s, 1928, 1930, approximately. And as far as I recollect, there were no films being made in Ireland. There had been some silent films made before that. But at that particular time, there was certainly no films being regularly made. So in that sense, it wouldn't have had any effect at all. I do feel, however, that it possibly generated some enthusiasm because The Dawn, which is one of the most extraordinary films, I think anyway, that was ever made in Ireland, which was made in, I think, 33, 34. The Dawn was made by a group of people who were amateurs in down in Killarney, and they learned how to operate a camera. They got a camera, they built lighting equipment and so on, but it was made as a sound film and it didn't seem to cause them any problem. Doing the job.
That the Irish would be as adaptable as anyone else as regards sound?
Oh, well, without any doubt. And we know this because we know that there are Irish men in working in the film industry in all sorts of positions in Britain and in America. And the recent Cinema Ireland exhibition, which took place earlier this year in Dublin, I think, brought this out in a most extraordinary way. I think most people were amazed at how Irishmen had got themselves into all kinds of places, including even Russia. But that's a big question.
Yes. But what was happening, of course, in the early 30s was that foreign companies came in, and one of the great films, of course, was Man of Iron.
Yes, well, then, was that really an Irish film? It was a film about Ireland, but I don't think it was an Irish film. It was one of the series of films made by Robert Flaherty, which you yourself, Crunchy, as a film historian, will know better than anyone else. He specialised in going to remote areas, even to islands. I suppose his best-known film is Nanook of the North, made something like 1922, in which he portrayed the life of the Eskimos. But in all his films, he's interested in self-sufficient communities who are living traditional lives, as they had for hundreds, possibly thousands of years. And some years after Nanook of the North, for instance, he went to Samoa in the South Seas and made a film called Moana, which I personally think is the most beautiful film he ever made. Shortly after that, he met somebody, I think it was on a transatlantic voyage, who said he should go and see the Aran Islands, which he did. And as a result of that, he decided to make a similar type of film about the life on Aran. And so he produced Man of Aran. But it was a Robert Flaherty film about a group of people living their own lives in self-sufficient ways, as I say, on a small group of islands.
The man who brought Robert Flaherty to Aran was Norris Davidson, who was one of the pioneer workers in documentary in the early 30s, and who later became well known as a producer of features, first on radio and then on television. He tells us how he started as a filmmaker.
I got a Kodak 16mm camera of my own and started doing the usual shots that one takes at home, and then embarked on, with Mary Manning, the amateur film that everybody made about suicide, which was called By Accident. And it was that got me into it. I was then bitten.
You became a professional afterwards. How did that come about?
Well, the 16mm film led to an appointment to work with John Gerson, which was really being trained. We were paid very little, but you did learn every single thing from cutting and joining right up to camera work, scripting and everything else.
Well, Grierson, of course, was the man to learn documentary making from.
Grierson was, because he and Flaherty were the fathers of documentary, and made the definition of documentary, which I can never remember exactly, because they changed it. The creative interpretation of reality, I think, that was the last one.
Yes. But you met all the other great British documentary makers as well, Rotha,
Wright. I did, because we were all working in the same cutting room, in the same place. Paul Rotha, not so much. Basil Wright, certainly. Arthur Elton, who died some time ago, he was head of Shell Films. Edgar Anstey, who's head of British Transport Films. Harry Watt.
Cavalcanti.
Cavalcanti, of course, yes, and quite a lot of others.
Well, they were really the great documentary makers. What sort of a group were they?
We worked very well together. One would be doing menial jobs for the other, simply taking stuff and cutting it and joining it, and then maybe next week the other one would be doing the same thing for you. Tremendous enthusiasm and tremendous help to each other, and a tremendous pub. You know, the place where we used to work, where we did a great deal of our talking and planning and gathering and dining in Soho. It was just on the edge of Soho, in Oxford Street.
Well, now, tell us about Flaherty, how you met Flaherty.
I met Flaherty when I was with Grierson. Grierson knew that I already knew the Aran Islands. Flaherty had a plan to go out there, because this mysterious man on the voyage over, who's never been traced, told Flaherty there's an island where they actually have to make the fields. Flaherty was thrilled by it, and Grierson said, you take him there and show it to him. So I showed him a bit of the country, and he wanted to sit down in Achill and work there, and it was with great difficulty. I prized him out and got him to Galway and got him out to Erin. Of course, then he wanted, almost immediately, we went back to Dublin after about several weeks there when I shot tests, and he found a very old 16mm Kodak wooden camera, which could be clockwork turned or hand turned. And he wanted to buy it and go back immediately and start the film. But Gorman British didn't want him to work quite, and blow it up from 16mm. Gorman British didn't want him to go into it quite so rapidly.
With his wife as assistant, taking still photographs daily and suggesting the scenario, with the men and women of Aran reenacting the life of the island, Flaherty set up his own processing laboratory and began shooting the sequences he wanted, very much as if he had been making a silent film.
In fact, this is the only way that a film of that type could have been shot. And I think any company, any producer at that time, if they were going to make a film what was really almost a spontaneous documentary, I suppose you could call it, if you were going to film people carrying on their normal activities, their natural lives, even today, in certain circumstances, the easiest way would be to shoot this silently, or mute, as we would call it, and then put on the sound afterwards. And in fact, in the case of Man of Aran, there was very, very little, although it came out as a sound film, it had mainly sound effects of waves. And as far as I remember, there was an interesting thing even of the voices. Voices were used in it, but purely as effects in the background. You didn't really hear what people were saying. And of course, they spoke in Irish, and there was no attempt to translate what they were saying by subtitles.
Man of Aran was one of the great documentaries of the early 30s, or indeed of any period since. But the fact that it was made in Ireland did not lead to the establishment of any documentary or other school of filmmakers in this country.
Well, there was people like Colonel Victor Haddock in the mid-30s, a man who was interested in films, and he obviously had money of his own, was able to put money into making films, made short films, and he made a number of shorts, and there were a number of other people like that who made short films. But again, as I think I mentioned earlier, they were all sort of single efforts. None of these people started a
industry came out of it anyhow.
No real continuity. I might be prejudiced, but I would feel that the regular production of documentary started with the courses in film technique run by the Irish Film Society in the early 40s, because there were various people such as George Morrison, who made Michiare and Saoirse, of course his best known films, as well as I was now working as a documentary producer. We had down there also Paddy Carey, who was in the running a photographic studio in town. He used to come down there, and at a later stage, Louis Marcus was a member of the Cork branch of the Film Society. But
and yourself,
this,
of course.
Well, this is where I started myself, and I think I got the inspiration, and my own interest in filmmaking was generated by my experiences in those early years in the Film Society.
Liam O'Leary, one of the founders of the Irish Film Society, was another of the filmmakers who emerged from it. But he is best known as a film historian and critic, and recently as the man who mounted the exhibition Cinema Ireland 1895 to 1976. He too would agree that the Irish contribution to the early sound film was slight.
Because in actual fact, in the sound period, apart from the comparatively recent development of documentary and odd things like The Dawn and Dennis Johnson's film Guests of the Nation and a few scattered things, the contribution is small compared to, say, the work done during the silent period. Of course, this is understandable because the cost of production, of course, skyrocketed with the coming of sound films.
But there were a few Irishmen working at films in the early 30s.
Yes. While the achievement may not have been a major achievement in any way, they deserve recording. For example, Colonel Haddock of Limerick, who was apparently an eminent explorer and writer, produced a sound film very early on in, let me see now, it was 1932, called The Voice of Ireland. It wasn't very much more than a travelogue with songs and little incidentals, but it at least was a genuine attempt to make a film about Ireland with an Irish theme. Then in 1934, Brian Desmond Hurst, who was to make many films in Ireland, but working from an English base with a certain amount of sympathy with his Irish background, made Irish Hearts, and that was in 1934. The following year, he did a version of Riders to the Sea, based on the Sing play, which, curiously enough, was financed by Gracie Fields.
And it was a bit of an oddity, I think, too, that particular one.
It was, because it was a rather superficial. Granted that Ireland always presents a good visual image, its scenery is always beautiful to look at, a film requires something more than that. It must have a core to it. And if the cake is not good, you know, it's small consolation that the icing is excellent. Now, in the same year as Riders to the Sea, two other figures came onto the scene, and that was Richard Hayward, the North of Ireland's entertainer and singer and writer, teamed up with an Irish-American called Donovan Peddlety, and they made a film called Luck of the Irish. It was something to see Irish scenes and Irish life on the screen. It didn't go very deep. It was a rather superficial representation, but at least it was getting nearer to the thing that we would like to see, and that is a real, genuine Irish film.
As the first decade of the sound film moved on, prospects for the genuine Irish film seemed to improve. 1936, says Liam O'Leary, was an important year.
Lots of things were happening that year. Donovan Peddlety made Irish and Proud of It and The Early Bird. John Ford had made The Plough and the Stars in Hollywood. And it was the year that Tom Cooper, who produced the first really genuine 100% native production, The Dawn, which in spite of its crudities, and, you know, some of its technical work was really excellent when you think of the colossal task that they faced in recording their own sound and doing their own development in Killarney and so on. But, of course, one must remember that Killarney had a tradition, you know, it stems from the old Caelum films. It was in their blood, I suppose, and it was natural that a film like The Dawn should come from a place like Killarney. But anyhow, that was the outstanding film, you know, of native Irish production. It had a lot of very, very good things. Some of the ambush scenes are as well directed as if Griffith had taken a hand in it. And another thing, Ourselves Alone, which I think was also directed by Brian Desmond Hurst, was made the same year. And it was also the first showing of, at the time, infamous Battleship Potemkin. And in the winter of 1936, the Film Society was founded. So there were a whole lot of things happening in 1 year, you know.
And you were very closely connected with that yourself, but we won't go into that.
Yeah, that's a long story.
I was asking you there about this film studio that was proposed, Liam. When did that
happen? Yes, it was in or around 1936, too. There was a proposal that not far from us here in Nutley Lane, a film studio should be established, and there were all sorts of talk about studios. Even Tom Cooper was talking about a national studio in Dublin, and I think everybody was thinking in terms of a national studio. Many films were being shot here, locations were being used. For example, Shuster's film Wings of the Morning with John McCormick. And I should have mentioned the very early sound film made by Frank Borzaghi, Song of My Heart, made in 1930 with John McCormick again. So Shuster filmed Wings of the Morning, his second John McCormick film, in 1937. And let me see what else happened around that time. Yes, the following years, you had all, there was a follow-up to the Dawn. There was a film called West of Kerry, or The Island Man, and Uncle Nick, also made by Tom Cooper, which weren't very successful. And Jimmy O'Dea played in a film, Blarney, and Richard Hayward appeared in Devil's Rock. There was one other thing with which... I was rather hopeful about. My friend Walter Moss from London, a very distinguished cameraman, came over here, and he and I were sort of working, but of course in a vacuum. There was no real official interest. People were rather afraid, I think, of the idea of a national studio or national film production. The country had other economic problems. Whatever the reason, there was no real... popular demand, because you know we weren't cinematically educated. The Film Society started in 36, and even their contribution is comparatively small, I think, in relation to what needs to be done. All these are drops in the ocean, and there just aren't enough drops, and there aren't enough big ones. Yeah. You know,
as Liam O'Leary has said, The Dawn, in spite of its many shortcomings, was the outstanding Irish film of the 30s. It was really a great communal effort on the part of almost the entire population of Killarney. But the mainspring of inspiration and achievement was, of course, Tom Cooper, the garage proprietor who produced and directed the film. He tells us now how he got involved in such a daunting undertaking.
Well, I had heard about the difficulty of making Irish pictures, and particularly about the idea of getting an Irish theme or getting a story. You had to have script writers, you had to have all sorts of people to prepare a script for you, and there was all sorts of difficulties. But I read a book, at least I had read it years before, and I remembered a very good story which could be applied to Ireland just as well as it could be applied to America. It was written by my namesake, James Fenimore Cooper.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He created a story called, was it The Spy? I think it was. He was an undercover man who was running between the two sides, but he was they just built him up like that. And I decided that I'd try to write a story on the same theme with an Irish background. And that was the origin of The Dawn, the story of The Dawn.
And it was made completely, processed, printed, photographed, acted, everything mm-hmm. was done locally.
It was 100% Irish from the point of view, except the raw stock, which I think was mostly Kodak or Gavert.
Gavert, that is correct.
Yes. Gavert,
that is correct.
Mostly Kodak or Gavert. And everything else was done, until it went on the screen, was done here in Killarney.
In the same year as The Dawn, Norris Davidson made the first March of Time film about Ireland. But 2 years earlier, he had returned to the Aran Islands to make a film called Aran Dances. He worked with a hand camera, and as there was no power available, he filmed the dancing and other sequences without lights in the open.
They were supposed to be out of doors. They were quite genuinely out of doors, and we post-synced the sound, took the accordion player over to London, he recorded it, and we cut it to his playing. It worked all right. I'd like to see that film again, but it disappeared. The company went bankrupt.
So no copies?
The receiver took the negative, and I don't know whether the receiver, the last I heard of him was before the war, and he was refusing to deliver the negative even then.
Was your next job then with the Empire Marketing Board?
No, the Empire Marketing Board was Grierson.
Oh, yes.
That was the name of Grierson's outfit. After that, it became the GPO and various other things. But that was Grierson's group was under the auspices of the Empire Marketing Board.
And you made some films in County Down, I think, or shot some sequences.
It was supposed to be a documentary about poultry and egg production, but it turned into a minor drama.
This was Hen Woman.
Yes, it wasn't very good. And it was burnt in the great fire in the GPO film unit some years afterwards.
God bless you. What was your next work then? You did one feature film, I know, with Lennox Robinson.
That was General John Regan. Then I came back to this country to start working here. I began by doing a small thing for the GSR, now CIE. Then I made some very disastrous ones for the tourist board.
Why do you say disastrous?
Well, the tourist board in those days was run on the subscriptions of the hotel keepers, the hotel owners. Therefore, when they set up the film unit, every hotel owner said, when is my hotel going to be shown, regardless of its suitability? They were disastrous. We parted in silence and tears.
The contribution of state and semi-state bodies to filmmaking in Ireland through the years has been considerable, but the association of filmmaker and sponsor has not always been a happy one. Colm O'Leary.
There are very few, if any, real documentary films made in Ireland, because a documentary film is one which has been said, and I have said before, is a film which presents an individual viewpoint and takes some general problem and deals with it. Well, quite obviously, a government department film is simply a piece of propaganda for that department or putting out a piece of information, or it's a film showing you how to use pedestrian crossings properly, or about the dangers of swimming or life-saving or something. And these are specific things, and they must be made as the department wants them to be made. Now, it's naturally, it's fair enough, the film, if the department is paying for a particular film to put over a particular message, the film has to put over that particular message, whatever it is. But a lot of us who've made these kind of films have found that we've had to put up with a great deal of interference. And I'm sorry to have to say this, but it's true. Especially in the case of government films, we found that civil servants tend to interfere in all parts of the production. And by this I mean they don't just tell the producer what they need in the film, what they want in the film, but they will tell him how to make the film. Now, they wouldn't tell a doctor how to take out an appendix, but they will tell a film producer how he should take certain shots and so on. And I've known myself in one or two cases where somebody in a government department actually changed scenes in the shooting script or rewrote sections of commentary which they didn't care for, didn't approve of. Well, of course, that wasn't their job. That was the job of the scriptwriter, the trained scriptwriter, or of the director who'd originally put the script together. And the proper way for them to do it was to say, well, look, we don't like the way such and such a section of the film is slanted, and could you change it? Paddy Carey, who is no longer working in Ireland now, has some scarifying stories to tell of his dealings with one or two of departments in which it took him up to 2 years to get them to approve the final script of a film he was going to make. In fact, Paddy Carey, who was our best-known filmmaker, and has won about a dozen international awards 18 months or so ago. He had to emigrate to England because he wasn't getting enough work to do here. And I think this points up a remark that John Borman, the feature film director, made some time ago, that we in Ireland were visually illiterate. And I think to some extent we all suffer a bit from visual illiteracy in Ireland, so that in that sense I don't think that official sponsorship did an awful lot. It certainly didn't do very much, if anything at all, to produce original documentary work in Ireland.
In the field of feature film, the outbreak of war in 1939 put a brake on any possible development here. But as soon as hostilities ended, many English companies in particular found the unspoilt Irish countryside a suitable background for some of their films. Liam O'Leary.
1945, I think, started it off. Olivier made his Henry V that power scored. The following year, Launder and Gilliatt made I See a Dark Stranger in the Rocky Valley outside Dublin. Brendan Stafford, who had graduated from the Film Society, was making a film, A Nation Once Again. That was in 46. And in 47, you had George Fleischman making Michael Davitt. And I made a film for Clanapublic at the time called Our Country, which I suppose was the first documentary film to have social consciousness. And I must say that Sean McBride put the cinema very much to the fore in his election campaign and was very consistent in that he actually did use the cinema. And in bringing the Cultural Relations Committee attached to the Department of External Affairs into existence, he did encourage the production of native films. And, you know, the sponsored documentaries almost all spring from that period.
And yet your film didn't get much of a show after that, Liam, did it?
Well, no, Our Country is the one that I made for Clanapublic there. And I think that was the millstone around my neck when it came to making Portrait of Dublin. Portrait of Dublin was never officially shown. It was made in 1952 and it was just brutally suppressed. And the reason for it, I have no hesitation in saying, was that I made Our Country for a political party. But again, the pattern continues, and Brendan Stafford made Stranger at My Door, shot in Dublin and London in 1950, and then really there was the spread of documentary films of various kinds, sponsored by the National Film Institute and other and government departments and so on.
And films like Captain Boycott as well, with an Irish theme.
Yes, of course, but they were very, very superficial. It was always Ireland seen from the outside. There was no sort of inner feeling in them at all. They were merely exploiting the exotic appeal of an Irish background. Because, you know, we have this thing that to an outsider, we are exotic. You know, we have this exotic thing, and this would be one of our greatest assets, of course, if you got a really genuine native film production.
Far from the exotic Ireland of the English and American filmmakers was the historic Ireland of Misha Éire, assembled in 1959. This unique film, like many others, came as a result of patronage. It had the financial backing and encouragement of Gael Lynn, and the dedication of one man, George Morrison, to the collection of historical film material was the basis of its success.
The beginning of my work in Irish material didn't start until 1952, because first of all, I was interested in actuality material in general. Then I began to discover, about 1949, that no work was being done to preserve and to catalogue our own historical material. And this led me to realise the necessity of some work of this kind. And as nobody else seemed to be interested in it, I began to do the job myself in my own spare time. I really made this one of my principal endeavours from 1952 onwards.
And as you discovered material, you made an index of that material and details of what exactly was available.
Exactly. Now, this was rather a special problem, because such a catalogue, a comparative catalogue of actuality material from many different collections, I don't think had ever been attempted before. Hence, I had to work out a lot of the rules of procedure for myself. And as you perhaps may realize, the classification of film material is a quite different problem from the classification of literary material. In the case of a book, you see, you have the author's name, and you can arrange a catalogue alphabetically under the author's name or the book title. But in the case of a film, it's quite a different matter.
You may have no title at all.
Yes, or who is the author of a film?
George Morrison was very much the author of Mishahara. His handling of the material was resourceful and imaginative, nowhere more so, perhaps, than where he had no actuality material to work on, as was the case for the execution of the leaders of the 1916 Rising.
In this case, I treated the whole of the sequence in a symbolic manner, in between each volley, coming back to the people, the actuality shots of people wandering around among the ruins outside the GPO in O'Connell Street and talking to one another, an armoured car passing through the streets, and so forth. And I think this conveys something of the shock and the effect of the executions on the people in Dublin in general, also conveys very vividly, I think, the sense of the time, of the extraordinary experience of seeing the whole of the centre of the city destroyed, which I believe was quite as potent as the executions themselves in arousing feeling the time.
No doubt it was. And there are some marvellous shots of O'Connell Street and the quays and actual buildings which are recognisable.
Yes. And then again, we're very lucky to have certain shots such as the little newspaper boy who holds up his placard.
That's very good.
And things of that kind.
Assisting George Morrison on Mishahara and on its successor, Saoirse, was a young Cork man who has since become one of our outstanding filmmakers and winner of many international awards. Louis Marcus first became interested in making films as a university student and as a member of the Cork branch of the Irish Film Society.
When I finished college at UCC, an opportunity arose to come up to Dublin as an assistant on Mishahara and Saoirse. And I, of course, leaped at this. And after a couple of months up here, I realised that I wouldn't get the chance to direct films of my own until I had proven I could, which is the vicious circle, really, that faces every aspiring filmmaker. So I returned to Cork, and with a few £100 and help from everybody and the loan of equipment, I produced a short film on my friend, the sculptor Seamus Murphy. It was called The Silent Art. It wasn't, I'm afraid, as good a film as it should have been on a subject like Seamus, but at least it got cinema distribution throughout Ireland, and it proved that I could see a film through from start to finish. And then I returned to Dublin in 1960, and I've been working here ever since, almost, on the making of films.
The experience of working on Mishahara must have been very interesting, really, for a young man like yourself.
Well, it was a fascinating thing, of course, because I hadn't realised any more than other people the amount of historical material which George Morrison had been able to discover in various archives. I had a very functional role on it. I should emphasise I can take no credit whatsoever for the film. I've just simply assisted George in a number of tasks. But it was certainly a fascinating introduction to Irish filmmaking.
And it was a pioneering work, of course, in its own way.
In its own way, it was pioneering for Ireland, of course, because it was feature-length documentary. It was also unusual at the time in so far as it was feature-length documentary from actuality material. We've become now terribly familiar with this through the television series about the wars and so forth, but at that period it certainly was an unusual film in all respects.
You continued the association with Gail Lynn then. What films did you make afterwards?
Well, the first two were the sort of twin films about Gaelic games called Pell and Christy Ring, and I made On Tine Bheo, the 1916 commemoration film, a film about Cork and the River Lee called Rhapsody of a River with Sean O'Riordan's music. And I worked freelance for Gaelin for quite a number of years. In recent years, I've been branching out with other sponsors and clients, but I certainly had a long run of perhaps even a dozen documentaries with Gaelin as the prime sponsors.
Now, all these films, I think nearly every film you've made has dealt with some aspect of Irish life or Irish people or their pastimes, something like that. Are these what you think are the really important things, people?
Well, I think so. I have no hard and fast sort of manifesto on the subject.
You're not dogmatic about it.
No, I mean, so many films are produced successfully on so many different kinds of subjects. There's no such thing as a subject you can't film. There's only a subject that an individual filmmaker can't film. But I seem to deal, for the most part, with people and the activities of people, and quite a number of these films have been observational films in that they have looked at life as it actually happens without using actors or setting up the action in any way. I think I've somewhat moved out of that style in the last few years. I've been working more on films that interpret what happens and that use actors or set up scenes for their action.
Louis Marcus in his own person brings the story of Irish filmmaking right up to the present day. But one important element has still to be mentioned, the setting up in 1958 of Ardmore Studios, which was thought by many to herald the beginning of a native film industry. John Houston, appointed chairman of an advisory council by the then Taoiseach Mr. Jack Lynch, spoke in 1969 of the aims of such an industry.
Mainly to tap the wonderful reservoir of talent that's here. Mm-hmm. It's not to give Ireland another economic asset.
Well, it will do. I think
which
this
I
will be
hope it will
a very
contribute
important
to.
Thing.
But rather to activate the writing genius, the acting genius that exists here.
And asked what progress his committee had made towards actual film production, Houston said,
Gerald Hanley is now writing, a very fine Irish writer, mm-hmm. is now doing a script on the East Rebellion. I think we're going to call it Holy Week.
Yes.
And that will go into production just as soon as the script is completed. And all the various parts of the thing can be put together. It's a big undertaking, a very big one.
And this is going to be completely Irish. Will there be an Irish company name on this?
It will certainly be an Irish film.
That was only one of the projected Irish films which did not materialise from Ardmore. However, it has to be remembered that the Ardmore studios could not at any time be regarded as film producers. They merely provided a technical facility. But such films as have emanated from there with an Irish background have generally made little impact either in Ireland or outside it. Colm O'Leary.
They made two kinds of films in Ardmore, as I see it. First of all, Irish films, which were really international versions of, Abbey plays and so on. The second type was just general thrillers or detective films. For instance, I saw a Dr. Fu Manchu film on television recently, and there was a party of horsemen galloping over towards Peking, but they were obviously going down the Rocky Valley through into Wicklow or somewhere. But Ardmore was a very good studio and very useful for people to come in and make all kinds of films, even science fiction films. But going back to you mentioned the Irish films. These became rather stage Irish. I think most people would agree. For example, George Shields' play, The New Gossoon, came out as Sally's Irish Rogue, a title which was apparently considered necessary to meet the world market. And unfortunately, I think a lot of these films were very stage Irish. One of the reasons was, of course, they were producers, directors coming in from outside. And in any country, you can't really understand. If somebody comes in from outside, they don't understand the way of thinking and don't understand the country they're moving into fully. And you run into problems. I must say that thinking back over the history of Ardmore and these films over the last 20 years or so, my feeling is that perhaps it's just as well that an Irish film industry has not got started, because in the film industry, the accent is on industry. It is an industry. It's not basically an art form. It's there to make money. And the producers, distributors and other people, they want to reach the widest possible market. And therefore, films must have the popular general appeal, which means, unfortunately, appealing to the lowest common denominator, if you like. Now, for this reason, I believe that Irish films, to sell well abroad, would have to conform to the Irish image abroad. And unfortunately, that is still one which thinks in terms of shamrocks, shillelaghs, begobbin, begorra.
The story of Ardmore Studios to date has been one of occasional optimism, intermittent achievement and frequent disappointment. People have become used to what has been called the annual reopening of Ardmore, and the last reopening at the end of 1975, under the management of Radio Telefiche Éireann and with a new name, Irish National Film Studios, renews optimism once more. However, in the context of a truly indigenous film industry, Ardmore should be seen merely as a helpful agent in providing services and facilities. Good Irish films can come only from good Irish filmmakers. The last word to Liam O'Leary.
In the field of documentary, yes, a great deal is being done. The work of Patrick Carey and Kieran Hickey and many other people, Louis Marcus, so on. I go on listing names forever. Colm O'Leary has done a great deal of work. You know, all these are genuine native films, and they look extraordinarily well on the screen when presented all together, as they were a few years ago by the Dublin Arts Festival, when they were all brought together, about 20 or 30 years of Irish films. They looked extremely well, and they had this Irish quality.
What would you yourself have liked to have seen done?
While nobody criticises my own country more than I do, nobody is more aware of its potentialities, and this is what makes me so furious when I see the difference, indifference and apathy and ignorance all around me in this particular field. Somehow people do not accept the cinema as something important, and yet it's been one of the major influences in our lives. One hopes that the new National Film Studios in Ardmore Bray will at some stage really produce Irish films that we could be proud of. For the moment, I understand their policy is to keep the studios fed with productions from outside. But let us hope that at last a gleam will appear on the horizon, and that we will express ourselves through this very great medium of the cinema, which has been respected and developed around the world. Why shouldn't we do it?